I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today. Thank you for joining us on Wisconsin Public Radio. As we just heard from NPR News, President Trump announced yesterday a 25% tariff on new imported cars and car parts beginning next Thursday. In an effort to boost domestic auto production and in the short term, making it as important as ever to keep your car running as smoothly as possible and knowing when it's financially feasible to be looking for a new automobile. With that in mind, it's time to talk about vehicle maintenance, and Jim Ward is back with us. He retired as service manager of Smart Motors Toyota a while back. He was with the company for 36 years, and we're going to start by talking with him about what you should do this spring to keep your car in tip-top shape. So, are you having problems with your car? Is it making a funny sound when it starts? Could you replicate that sound for us, please? We'd like to hear from you today. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email anytime to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. And Jim, welcome back.
Thanks, Lee. Thanks. It feels like spring out there, and it, you know, makes you start thinking about road trips and summer driving and, you know, things that it feels like we're going into an easier season, but yeah, summer and spring have their challenges for our cars too.
And some of that has to do with the remnants of winter, like the potholes we may be finding on the road this spring, Jim. So let's start there. What happens to your car when you hit a pothole?
Well, hopefully nothing, and usually nothing. And that's what gives us confidence that we, you know, drive around and don't necessarily watch them that closely. But it can do some serious damage. It can blow a tire. It can blow the tire and damage a rim. It can damage parts of your suspension. One of the simplest and easiest things you can do to help protect your car, besides watching for potholes and try to avoid them, which is not always possible, it comes down to your tires and proper inflation. Most cars now have tire pressure warning lights, which has been a great boost for tire life and tire safety. But they have about a 7-pound threshold, meaning that your tire can be 7 pounds low on air before that light's going to come on. So that's one of the first things, is to make sure those tires are inflated right. When they are, it's really amazing. We look at a car and think of the tires as traction and helping us with braking. But tires can make a huge difference in your suspension. It is the first line of defense for bumps and things on the road. And if the tires are in good shape and they're properly inflated, then they help your suspension. They absorb a lot of the road shock and help your suspension keep from having to take it all, and help keep the suspension and steering knuckles and linkages from getting more wear than they would if your tires were not inflated properly.
Quick Trips you can fill your tires at just about any Quick Trip anywhere across Wisconsin and other gas stations as well, and they come with their own tire pressure gauge. Should I be able to trust that tire pressure gauge pretty much, or should I have one of my own in my glove box?
It's a good idea to have one. They're not particularly expensive. You know, over the years, it'd be a regular drill we'd do a couple times a year, have all the techs in the shop, you know, check their gauges because they get off. And, you know, clearly for a tech who works in a shop and uses that thing many, many times a day, it may wear sooner and it might get inaccurate sooner. But there can be quite a variance in how tire pressure gauges read. And so that is definitely something I would recommend, is investing in a good tire pressure gauge. And, that's probably less than a $10 investment. But, you can't go just by looking at a tire. Yeah, the gauges are notoriously inaccurate. So
I'm just thinking about a $10 investment versus new tires for hundreds of dollars.
Right.
Just makes sense right out of the gate. But I we're here in Madison, and we've got 70-degree temperatures tomorrow, the possibility of snow next week. With these fluctuating temperatures in the spring, what does that do to our tires, and when's the best time to check our tire pressure?
Well, the weather change, particularly when the temperature drops 10 to 15 degrees overnight or more, we tend to see a drop in tire pressure. It just happened. It's a natural physics of the way a tire and rim are put together and the temperature dropping. It used to be we would have a little parade of cars on those days when the weather dropped temperature drops significantly overnight of people coming in with a tire pressure light on. So when we have those kind of temperature drops, that's a good time to take a look at it. You know, one of the things in particular that can be a little confusing about tire pressure and where you should put it is that every tire has got a tire pressure number on it, and that is the tire manufacturer's maximum pressure that tire should be put at. Unknown what kind of vehicle it's going to be on. That is not the pressure you want to set your tires to. Inside the driver's door jamb on the car, there's a little plate or a little sticker that will say what the manufacturer's recommended tire pressure for your vehicle are, and that's the number that you want to target and use to set your tire pressures.
Let's go to your calls now at 1-800-642-1234 for our guest, auto expert Jim Warden. We'll start with Steve and Phillips. Steve, good morning.
Hey, good morning. I've got a 2020 Ford F-150, and it has the 5-liter Coyote V8 engine, about 80,000 miles, and it's starting to use oil, like 2 or 3 quarts between oil changes. I see horror stories on the internet about, you know, engine replacement, and I'm just wondering if I should be worried, if I should get rid of this truck. I usually keep my trucks to 200,000 miles, but I'm wondering about this one.
You seeing any oil leaks, Steve?
No, it's on a clean driveway and nothing's leaking.
Interesting. Yeah. What do you think, Jim?
Well, yeah, and it would take a lot of massive amount of oil leak to go through it. Steve, what oil change interval do you use? How many miles are you going on an oil change?
The recommended by Ford, I forget if it's 5 or 6,000 miles.
Okay.
Always
that,
synthetic oil.
So that is quite a bit of oil consumption, you know, and that's it's an indication either that we've got piston ring problems or some kind of a valve seal leaking. It's not terribly difficult for a mechanic to take a look, pull a spark plug out, and take a look in with a little scope. To be able to make a determination which way it's going, you know, the main thing with that situation is to keep the engine full of oil. That means checking your oil pretty frequently, and you probably do. But, you know, there's typically not a simple answer to that. You know, and sometimes on some engines have a breather system that allows the crankcase to vent, and there's typically a valve in that system that's supposed to prevent that flow from ever going backwards, because that would be bad. And that valve is typically called a PCV valve, positive crankcase ventilation valve. In some instances, that valve can get plugged, and if it does, it can create some oil consumption. The rate that you have is probably more than that, but, you know, in our best hope of hopes, we always like to think maybe it's just a cheap, simple answer. And if it's going to be, you know, if anything's going to help it that's cheap and simple, it's going to be that breather system is plugged up a bit. And that's something that could be checked to see if that's something contributing to the oil consumption. But unfortunately, there is some history with that engine of what you're describing. Mm-hmm. The main thing in the interim is to you know, the using oil in and of itself can eventually in long term lead to some carbon buildup, but the real damage is done if you don't keep on top of it and let the engine oil get low. I mean, so as long as you regularly check that oil level and keep it full, the engine will keep running and will perform okay. But yeah, it's not a good sign. One important thing to note here too is that, you know, it does sound like you monitor your oil consumption. You've got a pretty good idea of what rate that it uses. You know, but in the meantime, we have this vehicle, or anyone who has a vehicle with that situation, be aware that in your day-to-day commuting and driving, the oil consumption will be whatever rate you've noticed, X, we'll call it. But if you go on a highway trip and suddenly drive all day long, that oil consumption per miles, that quart, you know, how many miles to a quart, can increase quite a bit. In other words, you can use more oil on a trip. So, you know, unfortunately, I hate to, you know, just be describing ways to manage oil consumption by putting oil in, but you know, short of it, what's probably going to end up being a major engine repair, engine replacement, that's the interim thing you can do. But yeah, be aware on a trip, check it probably every time you get gas, because it's going to use more oil then.
Steve, thanks for the call. Let's go to Christopher in Reedsburg next, who has a follow-up. Good morning, Christopher.
Good morning. It's in relation to, again, the individual's issues there with the 5-liter V8 and his F-150.
Yeah,
I'm aware of what he's talking about. That's definitely a known issue with that engine. My father has a 2019 F-150 himself with that same engine, and it's had that issue going on now for a good year, in a good year now, I'll say, and he has to keep putting oil into it. He contacted the manufacturer because he was fortunate enough to get it certified, and he's been tracking the consumption, fed it to the information to the dealership, and they will replace the engine, but it is a bit of a process in that he'll have to give the vehicle to the dealership so they can do a proper inspection, certify it to Ford, and then Ford will ship them a new engine to replace the existing one, and he'll be down the vehicle for a month.
A month. So, did he decide then that he'd just keep putting oil in it and keep up with it that way?
For right now, that is what he's doing until they can get a secondary vehicle in place that can be used, because right now my mother has to use the vehicle for work because she hit a deer back last fall. It was in the same spot, and a similar situation happened 8 years prior, weirdly enough. But it's definitely a known issue.
Christopher, I really appreciate the follow-up on that. And Jim, I have another question here about another V8 engine. Richard emailed, he had purchased a used V8 truck with 110,000 miles and wants to know if he can switch to synthetic motor oil from conventional oil at this point.
It doesn't hurt to switch back and forth between motor oils, you know, having the right weight of oil in it. The manufacturers will have increasingly been switching to synthetic oils. Synthetic oils have a little less drag. If you sell a whole fleet of vehicles as a manufacturer and you use synthetic oil in them, that whole fleet of vehicles will get an incremental increase in fuel economy that allows you, you know, to make and import more of those if they're imported vehicles. And that's one of the main reasons they do it. It isn't going to be a significant difference for one individual in one vehicle. One couple of other things that I would say about this oil consumption issue, Christopher's information is good. There, you know, manufacturers often have customer support programs, they call them, that are not necessarily really recalls, so you're not necessarily going to have Ford or any manufacturer reach out to you in that situation and say, hey, there's a problem you may have with your vehicle. So anytime you have something like that, you know, whether you do or don't service at the manufacturer, you know, at the Ford dealership, that's fine, but to contact them and find out if they do know about it. There are technical service bulletins about this particular Ford issue, and there's a class action lawsuit going on as well, which may result in, you know, an increased customer support program from what they have now. One other note about this, too, is that you can reduce that oil consumption by switching to a slightly thicker oil weight. So if the oil, I think that engine may require a 10W30 or 5W30. If you switch to 10W40, you may experience a little bit less oil consumption. But the rate that Steve originally, you know, described, 2 to 3 quarts in 5,000 miles, that's a lot of oil. And, you know, and it's, you're gonna, that means you're probably having to add a quart of oil about every 1,500 miles. So it takes some tenacity to stay on top of that. But that's the most critical thing. Just don't let the thing get low on oil and get some kind of damage, which they may then not cover, you know, because that's considered your fault if you let it run out of oil. But, it's frustrating when we have vehicles like this. It's not, you know, they say it's not super widespread. It's rare that it happens, but I don't know what your luck. My luck is that I tend to be one of the people that end up with one of those, you know, situations. So, you can switch back and forth between oils. The main thing is to have the right weight of oil or just one weight heavier than that, and you want to look at what the manufacturer's recommendation is for that so you stay in that range.
Yeah, appreciate the call, Christopher, and thanks for the email, Richard. We're talking to Jim Ward about vehicle maintenance today, and he's answering your questions. And we're asking you to try to make any sort of funny sounds that your car is making and see if we can't diagnose it for you. You can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today on The Larry Mueller Show here on WPR News. Stay with us at 12:30 today as we talk to a Lake Mills bike shop owner about keeping your bike up to speed and getting it ready to ride through the summer. But right now we're talking vehicle maintenance with our guest Jim Ward, and he's answering your questions at 1-800-642-1234. We were talking about tires a little bit earlier, Jim, and Ron from Independence has a question about tire pressure. Good morning, Ron.
Hi. I've got an 07 Toyota Prius, and my tire light is on all the time. I have changed the sensors because they told me I had two bad sensors. Now my sensors are supposed to be working, they say, and my light don't go off. It blinks and blinks, you know, it's like it's supposed to get the information, and then it goes on steady. I haven't really pursued it, but do you have any suggestions?
Well, the light is on or blinking because it isn't getting signal from one of those sensors. You know, it there are various different things that could go wrong in that system, but my experience, it is almost always a sensor itself. If I understood right, you replace two of them. In my experience, I've in doing those replacements, you can get the original manufacturer sensor, or you can get generic aftermarket sensors. With Toyotas in particular, I've had difficulty with the aftermarket sensors. I'm not necessarily against using aftermarket parts, you know, in any given application, but in that particular instance, I just tend to see this scenario. You put a new one in, and it just will not either initialize and communicate with the car's tire pressure computer that's looking for a signal for art, or it will it'll initialize it at first and work, but then it forgets it and falls out and doesn't. So you know, I would look back and see, were those sensors OEM Toyota sensors or not? If they weren't, that's probably suspect to be part of the problem. And if I understood right, if I recall, I thought you said you replaced two of them. That leaves two more, and it, for some reason, you know, they when I see them start to go on a car, they typically go out fairly close to each other. So if you replace two, it's possible it's the other two. But the dealer or repair shop can connect a diagnostic piece of equipment to the car and tell which of them is not sending a signal in, and then target that one. You know, you don't have to just randomly replace them all. So they can diagnose which one it is to get to the bottom of it. And I would, you know, in this particular repair instance, I would recommend going with the original Toyota sensors.
Hey, Jim, how do cars gauge the tire pressure? Do they know that they're all up to the same pressure, or do they know that they're adequately at pressure? How do they gauge that?
Well, the early tire pressure systems used rotation sensors. So they actually had a little ring attached to the axle that looked at the rotation with magnets. And you know, as the tire pressure changes, that rotation is going to be different. A tire that is inflated right is a greater diameter, and it's going to turn X number of times in a mile. And as that tire gets lower on air pressure, it's going to be a lesser diameter, and it's going to have to turn more times. And so the computer is calibrated. And now those were the early systems. The newer systems use like a radio frequency, and there's a vibration. There's a specific frequency that should occur when that tire is at the right pressure to give that signal to the computer. And if the tire gets low on pressure or too high on pressure, that frequency changes, and that these systems are a bit more advanced, and it can tell that and read that out, and basically the computer tracks, and you know, some vehicles have the ability to show you on a display on your dash what each tire pressure is, and if it's, you know, if you look at that and there's one missing, it just doesn't have a figure, and your tire light's on, that's the one that's not working. If not every vehicle has that display, but a repair shop can connect a diagnostic tool to the system, and then they can see it even if you can't on the dash, so they can tell which one it is. But that's how they work. You know, most vehicles currently use the ladder system with the frequency that's created by the right pressure in the tire.
Ron, appreciate the call. Thank you very much. We've got more tire questions for you, Jim Ward, now from Nick in Green Bay. Nick, good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My wife was coming back from out of town for my son's like basketball tournament. She calls me up and she's like, I just blew a tire. I'm like, not a big deal. It's going to be a 20-minute fix. Well, she's got a Ford Escape, and there's a screw in there that drops the spare tire. Well, that screw is completely frozen solid, so instead of being a 20-minute job, it was a four-hour job. And this is on the highway. They're doing like 70 miles an hour past me. Any suggestions on how to get that spare tire down? It's a terrible engineering thing that they put on there.
Yeah, it's underneath the carriage of the Ford Escape, right?
Yep. So many vehicles, so many vans, so many pickups have similar mechanical systems like that that basically get rusted. They get seized up. Mm-hmm. So number one, in terms of preventative, and even in the situation you're in, your first and best friend is a penetrating oil. You want to, you know, a few times a year, you know, get under there or take it and have this done somewhere, have them spray penetrating oil on the mechanism, wind that tire down, wind it back up a couple of times, keep everything lubricated and moving so that it doesn't have a chance to get rusted in a fixed position like that. Once something like that has happened, you know, and it's stuck and you're on the road with a flat tire, really it's still the, you know, your best hope is that penetrating oil will work. Penetrating oil won't work every time on every seized bolt, every seized thread, but, you know, you basically spray it on there and then try slowly working it back and forth to try to get, you know, if typically the way the penetrating oil works, you can move it a little further one way and then you tighten it back up and loosen it. And if you keep working that back and forth, usually you'll be able to free it up. You know, there's one of the things we could talk about at some point is a kit in your car that's got various things in it for emergencies, you know, from blankets to food, shovels, whatever. But one of those things should be a can of penetrating oil for it, stuff like that.
20 minutes to 4 hours on the interstate. Nick, I feel for you, and thank you for sharing your question. I appreciate it. We've got room for you now at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org with our guest, auto expert Jim Ward. We'll go to Craig in Eau Claire next. Craig, good morning.
Good morning, guys. Interesting show. My question is, I have a 2017 Ford Taurus, and my daughter has recently heard a little bit of a squeak when she's kind of accelerating and then turning some corners. And I looked at the serpentine belt and it appears to be okay. I'm just wondering what other things to look at or what might be causing this little squeak. It's just kind of a rhythmic, high-pitched squeak, 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 but real faint.
I appreciate the sound effects, Craig. And accelerating and turning the corners on a 2017 Ford Taurus. Any ideas, Jim?
Well, you know, Craig, I think that a dry belt would be a very common thing. And the belt, you know, the belt can look like it's in good condition. You know, cracks in the belt, which are usually one of the things the tech would look for, won't really necessarily cause a squeak. The belts can get glazed up, and that can happen from a lot of different reasons. It can glaze over time. It can be glazed up from something that was on the road, something that spilled, that splashed up and got on it. There are belt conditioners that you can spray on a belt, and if that is the noise, that would tend to at least temporarily quiet it down. So if there's a time it's doing it a lot, one of the simplest things you could do to eliminate that belt would get to some belt conditioner, spray it on it, drive it, see if circumstances where it normally makes it doesn't anymore. Could tell you if it is or isn't the belt. Otherwise, there are so many things in a suspension and steering system that could make that kind of a sound. It kind of comes down. I remember, you know, that's just one of the best part about having a vehicle that's got a sound when you're in a repair shop is the person describing it to you, that onomatopoeia. Could you say that a little bit louder? Because after that, it all just gets a little more difficult. You're trying to track down just where any given random sound is coming from. There are, you know, part of it is just experience and knowing what you've seen on a given model before. But again, belts are the most common things. You know, various wear and other steering components can also cause squeaks. But, you know, I would almost have to sit in and listen to it and then start trying to narrow down and trying to see how easily I can recreate it. And is there a given turn or a given thing that recreates it a lot? But I would start with that belt. That's still, I think you were on to a good thing. And in the majority of cases, in my experience, that is what it came down to.
Craig, thank you so much for the question. And how often would we, I mean, it's 2017 Ford Taurus, how often would we be thinking about changing the belts in our cars?
Well, belts and hoses are things that don't have an interval. They're not like fluids and other things where, you know, at so many miles or so many months or years that they should be replaced. They're the kind of thing that should be monitored. They should be inspected at least twice a year to take a look and see if they have excess cracking, if it looks like they're excessively gray glazed or getting too loose for any given reason. You know, over the years, that type of material that belts are made out of has improved considerably. I can't recall the last time I saw a belt actually fail and come off of a vehicle. So, you know, typically that used to be the circumstance under which they get replaced or you'd see a bunch of cracks in it, but anymore they're more often replaced when they start to develop an annoying squeak, you know, something like this one. So, you know, a belt could go 10 years easily on vehicles. On the other hand, I wouldn't be surprised to see any given bell have to replace maybe in 5 years, but I wouldn't expect anything any more frequent than that.
Thank you for the question, Craig. Really appreciate it. And we'll go to Andrew in Madison next. Andrew, good morning.
Good morning, guys. Andrew, thank you for the time. This was a really interesting conversation, and it sparked my interest. If this is not a relevant question, just hang up on me. That's fine. But I think it is, because a couple of these questions from other guests and other so here's my situation. I have two cars. I live downtown in Madison, Wisconsin. I work in healthcare. I have for half of my life, and I don't drive them. And I'm trying to see. So even talking about the belts and the oil conversation was really, really interesting. I'm trying to figure out what to do. If I have to go into hospitals, I'm right here. So I'm generally grabbing a bus pass and I just am not driving these cars, and that is not healthy for these cars. And they're both nice cars, but I'm trying to see if you have any advice. I understand plugging them in. One is not taking a charge. I just need a new battery. But when it comes to basically a car sitting,
I think it's a perfect question, Andrew. Yeah.
You have on what to do.
Yeah, because there's
That's something that is, many, many people starting after the COVID lockdown were able to work from home. Yeah. And Madison is a community where that, different communities may have different rates of that occurring, but Madison is a community where that occurred at a very high rate. And, suddenly people were finding themselves in exactly that situation where this thing isn't getting driven. Mm-hmm. Well, the best thing you can do is to drive it. Obviously, if you could make some time, even just once a week, to take that car out for a 15, 20-minute drive, the battery, the tires tend to want a flat spot when a car sits too long. Batteries will tend to fail earlier, in a car that doesn't have that regular charge and discharge. The battery's made to go through that cycle regularly. Condensation is more likely to build up inside of various assemblies in the motor and everything else. So the best thing you can do is to try to set some time aside to take it out for a 15, 20-minute drive. If you can't do that, there are many little things that you can do to try to mitigate the deterioration that occurs from just sitting. If you have access to a driveway or a garage and it doesn't have to sit on the street, you can get a smart charger that basically connects. You can just have a cord sticking out the front, the grill that looks like an engine heater or something that you can plug in. And that basically just charges the battery when it needs it, rather than just like a normal battery charger that's either on or off while charging. It's a smart charger. It senses when the battery needs a charge. So that's one thing you could do. Tire pressures, most manufacturers recommend in the winter months, because of an additional loss, actually increasing the tire pressure from the setting that is shown, 2 or 3 pounds. It just depends. There's little charts that show, but you could increase your tire pressure a little bit, not huge, but just a little bit. That's going to make them less inclined to flat spot. Keeping your fuel tank full is going to keep it from being as likely to get condensation in the tank and in the fuel system that would add water and cause other problems on its own. But with all of, and you could do a little research on your own too to find out what all you could do to mitigate it. But still, the best thing you can do is carve out 15, 20 minutes a week to go drive that car.
Jim, doesn't matter what kind of drive you take, just around town. Should you get it on the interstate?
You want to get it up to highway speed. You want to get up to highway speed. You don't want to, hit the brakes so hard you lock them up, but you want to create a little friction to get the oxidation off the brake rotors and get it out, long enough, 15, 20 minutes, and in some highway driving to be able to warm those tires up so that any kind of flat spots that were starting to form get worked out. You want to drive it that long so that the fluids all get heated up enough to try to burn out condensation that may be trapped in any given systems, and to allow lubrication to go completely through the systems. But Andrew was absolutely right. The worst thing for a car is to just sit. There's a lot of little mitigating things you can do, but none of them will be as effective as carving out some time to drive it occasionally.
Andrew, it was a perfect question, and I'm sure very helpful to many. So thank you so much for being a part of the show today. We'll go to Bill in Wausau next. Bill, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for the call. My problem is different from the other guys. I'm retired. I have two Priuses, and I live about 15 miles out of town. So anytime I have the car, it's running, you know, for a long time and warms up. But I don't put on many miles. And what I've been doing lately is changing the oil once a year in the fall. And I have it thoroughly checked over.
Well, you're kind of cutting out, but I think we get the gist. Two Priuses with low mileage, and what's the best maintenance for these cars that get a lot of work but don't have a lot of miles, Jim?
Well, that's not necessarily a bad thing if they're driven regularly. You know, if your drives aren't at least 15, 20 miles, I would recommend, again, similar to Andrew, taking them out and driving them a little longer occasionally to get them all warmed up. The oil change, we didn't really get how many miles you do drive in a year, but it sounds like the mileage is low enough that you're changing it once a year is likely to still be within the manufacturer's recommended interval. But what I would encourage you to do is really be on top of checking that oil. If you're going to go that long, if you're going to go a year, you want to make sure, A, that you don't have some oil consumption that may be beginning, and that's a long time to go, you know, if you don't check oil in between. So you want to get in the habit of checking the oil level on it just to make sure that the oil level is good. And you want to make sure that the oil looks right, that you don't open, you know, that you don't see like a white foam or anything on that dipstick. That's not common, but if a car is going to go, I like cars to be looked at and have a maintenance inspection twice a year. They really should twice a year, and it doesn't necessarily have to be an oil change every time. But if that's not being done every time, whether you do your own maintenance or have someone else do it, I would at least have the car looked at every 6 months, or look at it yourself every 6 months if you do your own maintenance to look systems over. And every one of those, again, does not have to be an oil change. That oil change once a year may be fine if you're checking the oil level and just taking a look that the oil looks okay on that dipstick. I would do that every couple months at least to look at the oil. So, yeah, that should take care of it.
Jim Ward, our guest, answering your automotive questions today at 1-800-642-1234. And, Bill, we thank you for the call. I'm thinking about Priuses and how they have the gauge for your battery right there on the console, and you can see that. And I'm wondering about battery maintenance when it comes to combustion engines, hybrids, electrics, and when you know it's time to replace them and when you should be getting them checked, Jim.
Sure. Well, what you're seeing on your Prius is reflecting what's going on with your hybrid battery. But that Prius also has a 12-volt battery like any other conventional car, and that is not something that you're seeing on that gauge. You're just seeing the hybrid battery. And the hybrid battery doesn't have regular maintenance other than your driving the car is what helps maintain that. The computer that runs it does everything that needs to be done. So the battery, the 12-volt battery in a Prius, just like any other car, is something that, again, when a basic maintenance inspection is done a couple times a year, one of the things that should be done is that battery should be tested. And one of the great things about modern battery testers is they have the ability to test potential. So that means that you don't have to wait until click, 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 or no click, and nothing happens. You know, the shop can tell you this battery is, you know, it's not imminently going to fail this week, but it is on its last legs and something you should think about replacing. So that's something that should be done twice a year, and that's really how you stay on top of the 12-volt batteries. You know, most cars have maintenance-free batteries anymore. If you do your own maintenance and you have an older car, you may have a battery that still has cells that can have distilled water added to them, and you need to check those, but that's far more rare. That's not typical.
Thank you for that. And let's go to Gary in Milwaukee next, who has a tough choice to make. Good morning, Gary.
Good morning. So I have a question. It's not really maintenance, but I have a 2006 Nissan Frontier that is almost flawless. It's got 175,000 miles on it. It requires nothing but routine maintenance. I do have one question I didn't mention to the person who answered the phone about the headlights. But the real question that I asked for, that I wanted to ask when I called in, I now have the opportunity to get a brand new truck. And I'm wondering if Jim can offer the logic I should use to justify getting rid of this 2006 truck, which frankly only gets about 16 miles to the gallon.
Yeah, but it sounds like you love it.
I do love the truck. So does it make sense to go to a new vehicle, environmental wise or mechanical, whatever it is. I said the headlights. The one thing I don't care for, the headlights are not that bright. And of course, as I get older, my eyes aren't that good either.
Right.
But I'm just wondering if you can offer advice on swapping out incandescent bulbs in a truck like this with LED bulbs. I'm getting some confusion from the places I go to, and they say, well, put in fog lights, but you're not supposed to put in fog lights and all that stuff.
Yeah, thank you, Gary. And Jim, let's start with the easy question about the headlights.
Sure. I mean, you know, I'm not familiar with the specifics of that vehicle and which headlights it calls for, but you can upgrade headlights. It shouldn't be rocket science. It sounds like you've run into, and it may be because it's an 06 and it just there may not be a compatible LED or xenon type bulb that would be brighter, but part of it, without looking at the truck, some of the things that happen on an 06, I'd be kind of surprised if the headlight lenses didn't have some fogging. That can be an element in this. You might be amazed how inexpensive. The original Nissan factory headlight assemblies might be fairly expensive, but I over the years, my kids and I have our family has had various things happen to headlights. You hit a turkey or whatever. So I'm not above buying a aftermarket headlight assembly. And I was just shocked at how inexpensive they were. So if you have fogging on the headlights, or if the reflective surfaces, the chrome, reflective surfaces inside are starting to break down, that's going to affect how bright it is too. So if those are the case, even putting in an LED bulb it's going to help a little bit, but it's not going to help that much. So, it depends really on why the headlight's not as bright. But those are some things to think about in that area. I love older vehicles. I've always been an older truck kind of guy, older vehicles. It's cool to keep them going. You think about, 175,000 miles, no problems. And really, vehicles that haven't had a lot of problems, I don't see tend to start having problems. That vehicle may very well make 200, 250, 300,000 miles.
Wow.
You'd love it when you're sitting in it, taking pictures of that odometer and telling all your friends. But I'll tell you what, the few times in my life, I stubbornly hang on to vehicles. I just love that the vintage feel of an older vehicle. And, but when I have upgraded and got a different vehicle, it's like, man, I didn't know what I was missing. Various different safety features and just conveniences that another vehicle would have can spoil you pretty darn quick.
What about gas mileage?
Well, and fuel mileage, too. You never know what is going to happen with the winds of change, but I have a feeling that the price of gas is not going down. That those are factors. It is a tough decision, but go out and drive some of those newer vehicles that you're thinking about getting. Go out and drive it. Maybe even see if you can get them to let you drive it overnight and drive it for a day and see, how you like those the new drive system, the different things that it has. The factor isn't just the ergonomics of it. Newer vehicles are safer. There's no two ways about it. If you get in an accident, and that's something that you can't plan for or prevent, you're going to be safer in a newer vehicle. You're going to get better mileage in a newer vehicle. You're probably going to be more comfortable in a newer vehicle. So as much as I like vintage vehicles, it's always better if they're a second vehicle.
Gary, it sounds like you got a tough choice, but there are no wrong answers. And thank you for calling this morning. Our guest is Jim Ward. He's answering your automotive questions and any maintenance you may have, any sounds your car is making that you want to make for us. 1-800-642-1234 or email talk at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to WPR News. Tomorrow on Garden Talk, you're going to hear how to grow your own berries, and we'll get some advice for starting your seeds indoors from Diana Elf, who joins the Larry Mueller Show. That's tomorrow from 11 to 1 right here on WPR News. I'm Lee Rayburn, and for Larry, and our guest is Jim Ward, automotive expert, answering your questions, and we've got a full bank of phone calls here, but before we get back to that, I've got a follow-up headlight question for you, Jim. Lily emailed. She's got a 2015 Subaru Forester that keeps burning out headlights. Any ideas on why?
Well, there are a few possibilities for why a headlight may fail more often. The modern headlights are kind of an unusual bulb. So one of the critical things when replacing them is that it's not okay to touch the bulb like the old You know, movie projectors that, you know, you don't touch that bulb before you put it in. Just a little bit of grease from your finger can make it fail. So one possibility is simply that in the replacement process, someone has handled the bulb wrong, and that could cause that as well. That bulb goes into a little socket that then screws or gets wire clamped or wire baled clamped into the back of the headlight assembly. If that is not in there properly, and if the seal doesn't seal and moisture is able to get in there, that is going to shorten the life and cause the bulbs to fail more frequently. And to a lesser likelihood, there could be something in the wiring that could be a corroded connection or a ground that's not making a good connection that could lead to a shorter headlight life. But most of the time, in my experience, headlights that are failing too frequently are either from how they're being handled or from the fact that it's not sealed properly in the headlight assembly.
Have another question about Prius this morning from Ken in Fish Creek. We'll go there next. Ken, good morning.
Yeah, you still there?
Yeah.
Are we there?
Yeah, go ahead. Can you hear us? Think we lost you, Ken. I apologize. We'll go to Ellie in Madison next. Ellie, good morning. You're on the air with Jim Ward.
Good morning.
What do you have for us?
So I have a question. I've got a question about my minivan. So I have a 2013 Dodge Grand Caravan that does not get driven very often at all. I had it in recently for service. It got an oil change and tire rotation. And then it sat in my driveway for like 3 weeks. Then when I went to start it up this past weekend, it had a check engine light on. So I went and got the code read, and it said it was a EVAP fuel vapor leak, and it said it was a very low leak. I'm just wondering if that has to do with it sitting for a while, and if it's something that might go away as I drive the van more, or if it's something I need to address right now.
An EVAP fuel vapor leak, Jim.
Yeah. So what this is about is the fuel tank's a sealed fuel tank, and it's not supposed to let any of those vapors out. So the most common way that they get out is the gas cap's not tightened properly. When you get fuel, you're supposed to turn the gas cap till it clicks, and you should not put fuel. I mean, you are fueling the vehicle up. You should not add fuel after it clicks off when it's full. You don't want to top it off. That excess fuel can get into that vent system and cause some issues. But the vast majority of the time, a minor leak, a code that indicates a minor leak like that, is often just the gas cap's not tight enough. Now, sometimes the top of that fuel filler neck that the gas cap screws onto can get a little bit of corrosion on it, and that can make it difficult for the seal to seal. And, you know, sometimes they could just be wiped off. It's something that you want to be a little careful. You don't want to be sanding on that and letting any of that corrosion that might be there get down into the fuel tank. So, there, you know, if it does look like it's got some corrosion, you want to stuff something, a little rag or something down there before you wipe that off. But that, in all likelihood, it's just a loose gas cap. One of the things to keep in mind, if that is true and it's just a loose gas cap and you tighten the gas cap up, don't expect to start it and see the light off, because the system, the diagnostic system, uses what they call a two-trip logic. It wants to see that that problem's okay on two trips before it shuts the light back off. So you're going to have to probably drive it 15 miles twice, even if that was it. You tighten the cap, probably going to have to drive it 15 miles, shut it off, drive it 15 miles again before the light, before the computer will say, yeah, the problem's okay, I'm going to shut the light off.
Let's hope it's something that simple, Ellie, and thank you for the call. A follow-up here from Jennifer, who emailed to ask whether or not gas gets stale or goes bad over time when your car goes unused.
Good question, and yes, it does. Gas does get stale, and you can put various products in it. And again, one of the themes that we seem to be hearing more and more is, I just don't drive it. And
yeah.
And again, I think that's an increasing reality for a lot of people. And so in that situation, you know, one of my personal favorite products is something called Seafoam. You can buy it in a can, and you can put it. It doesn't take a lot. It's not expensive. It doesn't take a lot, but it stabilizes the fuel so that it doesn't tend to break down. Fuel that breaks down can make starting more difficult. It can make the fuel less efficient, so you don't get as good a mileage. As it breaks down, it turns into some gums and resins that can plug up various things in the fuel system. So, you know, if you don't drive a lot and that fuel's got to sit in there a long time, mm-hmm. a month or two, you definitely want to look at something like that. There's another product called Stable. Seafoam is another one. There's a few of them out there that are just made to stabilize fuel like that. And that, in that situation where you don't drive a lot, that's definitely something to consider.
Well, here, Andrew and Madison just emailed to ask what you think about Seafoam versus Stable in your gas tank. And Andrew also points out octane does not last. So how do you get that old gas out of your car?
Drive it, burn it, get it out of there. You know, it's, I mean, you know, you can, you know, that typically if you have a fuel problem, you're better off if you have a half a tank to add. Assuming you're not having problems, you're just worried about being old, just add new gas as quickly as you can. Half a tank of additional new gas is going to cut the problem in half, for example.
Okay.
And even if the gas is old, putting some Seafoam in there or any other fuel stabilizer product will help. You know, again, Stable versus Seafoam, I just like Seafoam. I've used it. I used Stable years ago, I've switched to this. I mean, I use it in everything. I use it in my lawnmowers and my snowblowers. I use it in my chainsaw and all the other devices that in two cycle oil. It's a great product, and you know, it can not only stabilize your fuel, but it can help clean out your fuel system a little bit too.
Seafoam everywhere for our guest Jim Ward. We go to Janet next, who's in the UP. Good morning, Janet.
Good morning. Hi, Jim Ward. I have a question. My son bought a Toyota 2024 hybrid, and twice now they coat the wires with a soybean product, and rodents have chewed on them, squirrels. Hmm. And according to looking at some websites and that, Toyota doesn't think it's a wiring problem. They think it's a rodent problem. But I guess there's been class action lawsuits and all that. What can someone do to prevent critters from gnawing on wires?
Jim?
Sure. Capsaicin tape. There is tape made to put over those wires that has capsaicin. In other words, it would be like cayenne pepper. Yeah. Rodents do not like cayenne pepper. So you get capsaicin tape, you tape it over that. And the weird thing is when a given rodent picks on wires at a given point in the car. I've seen this happen. I had someone come in, they had a right rear wheel, you know, tire pressure sensor wire they got chewed through, had to do a repair on it, come back 2 weeks later, that exact same point, the same critter obviously came back. So if you don't do something like the capsaicin tape, they're going to come right back to that same place because that was good. Toyota insists that it's not soybean that their wire insulation is made out of, but it's something, you know, that was supposed to be more environmentally friendly than the old plastics that were used on them, and something that would last longer. And I don't care if it's soybean or not, rodents do like it. It's not just Toyotas, it's all different kinds of vehicles that they seem to be attracted and like to eat that insulation off. But the capsaicin tape is definitely the end of the problem. You put that on, and unfortunately cars have a lot of wiring.
Yeah.
And you know, it's not all exposed, but some of it is, and so it's not going to be practical to get capsaicin and cover all the wiring in your car, capsaicin tape and cover all the wiring in your car with it. But once you've had a problem, putting it in that place could be enough, because the rodent that in question is probably going to come back to that same point, and once he gets a mouthful of capsaicin, he's probably going to say, you know, cars are probably not a good place to eat.
Now, is this something I can do myself, or is this something that I'd need a mechanic to help with?
People's abilities vary. I never want to tell somebody you can't do something yourself and you have to go pay to have it done, because you can Google things. Man, I'll tell you, I've done so many things I never thought I could do. I considered doing my own appendectomy, but I drew the line there. But you can Google so many things and figure out how to do them. So don't underrate yourself on what you think you might be able to do. But be smart, too. If you're reading and it doesn't make sense and it just doesn't seem like this is in your wheelhouse, get some help. Have somebody else do it. Something else I'll say is, you know, just in this particular one, you know, just like cooking with cayenne pepper, if you handle that capsaicin tape, don't scratch your eyes or your face, and you've got to wash your hands, because it will get you.
Jim Ward, our guest, automotive expert, answering your questions, and they've been great questions and even better answers so far, and our conversation's going to continue over the next 30 minutes, and we invite you to join us at 1-800-642-1234. We invite you to make car sounds over the phone at 1-800-642-1234, as some of you have. Also, email talk at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn, and for Larry Mueller today, this is WPR News. We'll be right back. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today. It's the Larry Mueller Show. I asked Larry yesterday what his first car was. It was a 1960s Mercury Comet, a model they don't make anymore. My first car was a 1970s Toyota Corona, not Corolla, Corona before the beer. They don't make that model anymore either. Our board operator today, Jeff's first car, a 1980s Dodge Colt. When's the last time you heard about that? We're trying to keep your car on the road today with our automotive expert, Jim Ward, who joins us with answers to your vehicle maintenance questions. Jim retired as a service manager at Smart Motors in Madison, where he worked for 36 years. Before I get you a phone number, let me get you a phone line, because we've got folks waiting with their questions for our guest, Jim. And we'll start with Jan in Viroqua. Jan, good afternoon.
Hi. Are you there?
Yeah. What's your question? Yeah.
I'm driving a 2005 Honda CR-V with 210,000 miles on it, which has been a very faithful, flawless friend. What would explain a sudden drop in gas mileage? I had been doing maybe between 15 and 18, and last time I checked it, it was 10 or 12.
And how many miles did you say you had, Jan?
210,000.
That's great. So has anything changed about the your driving, the distance you drive, or the trips
not
that you
really,
take?
No.
Not really.
No.
So this can come down to a couple of simple things. We've been talking about tire pressures today, and typically if your tires are low on air, they don't have to be very low for it to start affecting your fuel mileage. About every 3 PSI is going to be about 1% less efficient. So if you're 10 pounds low, you may not really notice that driving the car, but that's going to be 3% waste of fuel. Another even more significant factor can be a dirty air filter. If the engine's air filter is dirty, it can drop your gas mileage considerably. And again, you would think that would give you some performance issues you'd notice, but I've seen it over and over where it didn't really seem to appreciably change the performance, especially if you're not out there pushing the limits of the performance. You're just a normal driver. You're not really going to notice that difference. So those would be the two most likely things, and very simple things that I would take a look at is get the tire pressures checked and get the engine's air filter checked.
How often would you think about changing your car's air filter?
I like to see air filters checked twice a year. You know, you can make whatever kind of schedule you want, but something can happen. You know, I can give you an analogy of my house. You know, we have a schedule that I change my furnace filter on. Well, I've been doing a little remodeling and cutting up a floor and replacing it. And, of course, that creates a whole lot of sawdust in the house. And, you know, taking a look at that furnace filter and thinking, boy, I didn't replace it that long ago. But, duh, of course, because of the conditions I created, it got dirty quicker. So, you know, you're out driving, you know, and just – different conditions. If you get behind the salt truck, if you get in suddenly very dusty, dry conditions where there's dust blowing on all over the place. I remember one time driving along the Mississippi River and having this cloud of mayflies working its way up toward the road and getting so thick, you know, that I was wondering if my engine was going to quit running. Little incidents like that can take a clean air filter to a dirty air filter a very brief time. So it should be checked at least twice a year. But if you found yourself driving through a dust storm, check it right afterwards and make sure that didn't take it out.
A couple things for you to check, Jan, and thank you for the call. We'll go to John in La Crosse next. John, good afternoon.
John, I've got a Toyota Camry 2013 that has an odd situation that we can't seem to ferret out with our favorite mechanic. All of a sudden, driving along at 30, 40 miles an hour, maybe 50, we get a shake in the car with a loud rattling sound, and I can feel it through the floorboards and the brake pedal and whatnot. We'll pull over. We'll stop and look underneath the car, see if we can see anything, you know, maybe a stick stuck somewhere. And then we'll keep driving to get home. It's only a couple miles away. Problem will go away. It's happened three times in the last couple of months. And again, our mechanic took the car and drove it around and kept it overnight, and it didn't work for him, and he can't see anything wrong underneath the car.
John, does it make a noise when it starts shaking?
Oh yeah.
Can you tell where that noise is coming from?
It certainly sounds like it's coming from the back end.
Well, you know, I could tell you that what you're describing is kind of a classic. You know, it could be something else, but one of the problems that a 2013 Camry had was related to a device called the torque converter in the transmission. And in fact, Toyota issued a warranty enhancement program for that torque converter problem. It's called torque converter shutter. You know, it just about feels like you're going over rumble strips. It's not quite that that much vibration, but it's that kind of a impression that you get, like, did I just run over a rumble strip kind of thing? And, you know, it tended to be a matter of replacing the torque converter, lockup torque converter, to correct it. You know, I don't remember that I really saw breakdowns as a result of that. It could be a very disconcerting feeling and a disconcerting thing to happen, you know, and on some of the vehicles too, it wasn't really even a matter of replacing the torque converter. It was a matter of a software update and how the transmission's computer operated the transmission. And, you know, you drive a vehicle like that, and if you could see what gear you're in, you'd be amazed sometimes that in town at 25 miles an hour, if you're not under much load, it's up in fifth gear. And you think you'd never drive a manual transmission and be in that situation. But that can create a situation where you have more torque converter shutter. So that's certainly what this sounds like. And, you know, it I don't know that the warranty enhancement would still cover this on a vehicle that age, but I would contact a Toyota dealer and find out more specifics. I can't tell you off the top of my head how long that warranty extension went for, but I think that is what you're experiencing. You're describing the classic symptom of it.
Thank you for the answer. Good luck with the car, John. We'll go to Heather in Fall Creek next. Heather, good afternoon.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I was wondering, I was recently in a fleet vehicle shuttle to Minneapolis that has like 500,000 miles going strong, and I was just thinking, wow, that's incredible. Is that something I can expect from my 2016 Subaru if I maintain it well?
How many miles does your 2016 Subaru have, Heather?
230,000.
Oh, almost halfway there, Jim.
Yeah, those are both impressive numbers. Well, one of the keys to that is maintenance. You know, one of the things that you'll find about fleet vehicles is that the maintenance gets done, you know, on schedule, like an alarm is set, and they always get maintenance. So if you maintain your vehicle, you know, specifically regularly, right according to the manufacturer schedule, maybe even a little bit more aggressive, you're going to get better mileage and better, you know, better life out of the vehicle than you would otherwise. 230,000 miles out of a 60, out of your Subaru is great. It is. I would be surprised to get 500,000 miles out of most any vehicle. Once you get over 300,000 miles, you are in, you know, thin air, you know, essentially, and anything can really happen in a vehicle when it gets up into that mileage range. So I would not expect to get that out of most any vehicle that most of us are driving to get 500,000 miles, but it happens. It does happen. People do get that kind of mileage out of it, but it's not something I would bet on or expect to happen.
Thank you for the call, Heather, and good luck with the Subaru. Let's see how far it can go. We'll take John in Madison next. John, you're on the air with Jim Ward.
Hey, hi there. Thanks for the call.
What do you have for us?
Well, I have a fun vehicle. It's a short bed GMC pickup, 2011, so it's modern. It had a little six-cylinder, but I put in a crate motor, 500 cubic inches, from Chevy Performance. Well, I have a problem. It only has 2,400 miles, and I'm on my second starter. It's a Hitachi. It's an Hitachi. The mini starter staggered, and it seems like it will grind on the flex plates. And then one time they actually replaced the flex plates. Is it an alignment issue? Is my mechanic know what he's doing? I can't do the work.
Well, this is over my head, but you've got a new motor. You've got a short bed 2011 GMC truck. You've had problems with your starter and your flex plate. How do you all lay this out for a mechanic, Jim?
Well, the engine is the starter is an electric motor that's got a small little gear that pushed out by a solenoid to contact the flex plate, which is attached to the flywheel of the engine. It starts the engine turning, and that helps build the momentum for the engine to be able to start easier, to be able to start at all. And it certainly does sound like there's some misalignment there. Because if they don't engage properly, obviously the gears are going to start to grind, and you're going to, one or the other, whichever one is a softer metal, the flex plate gear or the starter's solenoid Bendix gear is going to wear out. So this is not an easy one, because now we've taken a stock vehicle, we put in a high performance motor. I'm guessing that starter came with that high performance motor. You're certainly not likely using the starter that was on the previous motor. I don't think that would even be possible. So, I unfortunately don't have a simple answer for you, other than that I agree with your hunch that it isn't aligned properly or something is coming loose. When you put that engine into a car, you're probably not putting it in there for gas mileage, and probably not putting it in there to be able to drive it mildly. So, your mechanic has probably already checked to see that starter hasn't come loose, but again, in high performance situations, those are the kind of things that can happen, when a vehicle is driven hard. I don't know the answer, but the most likely scenario is that they're not aligned right, or something is coming loose and causing a misalignment that's going to continue to cause starter and ring gear issues until it gets resolved. So somebody that's got high expertise in replacing engines with higher performance engines is where you want to be.
John, thank you for the call. And who remembers the 90s? Paul and Thomas reminded of the 90s every time he drives his Dodge Ram. Paul, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I will pay homage to the gods if you get this one. It's a 1998 Dodge 1-ton, 5.9 liter Cummins diesel in it, Arizona truck, so it's rust-free. It sat most of last winter, not this winter, the previous one. And when I came back with another vehicle, I had to replace the throttle positioning sensor because there's a dead spot in it. But now the torque converter, when you're going down the road 60, 70 miles an hour, the torque converter keeps kicking in and kicking out, kicking in, kicking out. Watched all the YouTube videos, did all the snake oil treatments. Any ideas?
Second question we've had about torque converters this afternoon, Jim.
Yeah. And it's not a common area to have a problem on a vehicle. But it sounds like you've tried some kind of additive in the transmission fluid to try to address this. Is that right?
Not in the transmission fluid, but I've tried. You put aluminum foil on some of the wires. I've tried to recalibrate the throttle positioning sensor. There's a little aftermarket gizmo you can buy where you poke it into one of the computer wires, which seems like, well, if this worked from the factory, why doesn't it work now? It's not an uncommon problem, but all of the clubs out there don't give me a solution that seems to work.
Well, the throttle position sensor failing, having been replaced and then having this problem, would suggest that there's something there that's not getting the right signal. And, that could be the case. And, that it sounds like you've done all the tweaking you could find sources for. One of the other things that can cause that, though, is an improper transmission fluid level. Maybe that's been checked. But if it hasn't, that's somewhere else I would go. Again, you get into a situation where throttle position sensor failed, you replaced it, it could possibly be related, and we kind of get stuck in a loop of, it's got to be this, when it could be something like the transmission fluid level. So, you may be right. Unfortunately, I would like to just slay that one and tell you I had the answer. I don't have a simple answer. It may be something related to the throttle position sensor and the way things are adjusted, or it may be something else entirely, like the transmission fluid level. But that's the thing I would check next if you haven't done that already. Make sure that fluid level is right, because if it's low, it can give you that kind of a symptom.
Paul, thank you for the call. We'll go to Gerard next in Marshall. Gerard, good afternoon.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good, thank you. What do you have for us?
I have a 2006 Ford 500, and I start it up, and it makes a something's rubbing on plastic noise. And then as soon as you put it in reverse or drive, it goes away. I think it's got a CVT transmission in it.
Well, CVT transmission's probably not making that sound. What describe that sound a little bit more, kind of, or if you could imitate it, what do you get?
Well, like if you put a piece of plastic in spokes, kind of
sure,
like that.
Okay. Okay, and it occurs the moment the engine starts. It goes, and how long does it go?
It'll go as long as you don't put it in park. If you leave it in park, it does it all the time or neutral. But if you put it in drive or reverse, it goes away.
Well, I don't know what it is, but I do know that that circumstance is the best scenario you want. The most difficult thing to find is something that's intermittent. So you've got something that you can depend on making that sound. And, you know, sometimes it comes down to good old-fashioned diagnosis, like literally with a stethoscope. You know, they make stethoscopes. They got a little rod that you can start putting on different things and narrow down. In fact, they even make these devices that you can put little alligator clamps on various devices and, you know, drive down the road. But in this case, the ideal thing is that it'll do it just sitting there as long as you haven't put it in gear. So, you know, I don't know what that is, Gerard, but I do know that it's going to be one of the easier ones to diagnose because of the fact that it will do it consistently. It doesn't do it intermittently, and that's what I would be doing, is taking out my handy-dandy mechanical stethoscope and putting it here and putting it there while it's making the noise to narrow down where I think it's coming from.
Yeah, so it sounds like you'd be able to isolate where the problem is, and that would be the road to fixing it. Thank you for the call, Gerard, and we'll go to Trent in Wausau next. Trent, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I've got a 2005 Ford 3-Star that drives fine most of the time. When you get on the highway, it starts to have a shimmy or shake to it around like 55 to 65. If you're going over 70, it calms down and doesn't have that shake to it. Any ideas?
And where do you feel that shake? How do you sense it? Through the steering wheel, yep. Through your seat?
Yep.
Well, that it's a classic description of a tire balance problem. Tires are – a tire that you put on a wheel is never perfectly round and perfectly symmetrical, so there's a machine called a tire balancer that spins it up and has a little computer that calculates and tells you if you put a quarter of an ounce weight right here on this rim, it's going to counterbalance the quarter ounce that the other side of the tire is off. And when a tire is out of balance – it'll cause a shake like that, and it will be a very specific speed range shake. It won't do it below that. It won't do it above that. It does it in this range. Wheel bearings, other things can cause a similar shake, but the vast majority of the time, that's going to be a tire balance issue.
Thank you for the call, Trent. And we'll go to Marcia in Door County next, who's got a comment about the Subaru. Marcia, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Yeah, I just wanted to wish the woman who wants her Subaru to go 500,000 miles. I had a 2006 that went 315,000 miles, and actually the engine and everything ran quite well, but the body fell apart.
Well, that is a marathon, but it does bring us to what we can do to protect the body of our car. While we've been looking at the transmission and the suspension, what about the exterior, Jim?
Well, you know, we live in a harsh climate for cars here. You know, it's amazing to go southwest in this country and see those cars from the 90s that we remember. They still have them driving down there because they don't have salt, and salt is very hard on the car. So, you know, throughout the winter months, you know, when you have to drive in those conditions, you want to, as quickly as you can afterwards, go get an underwash, get the car clean, get that stuff off of the car as quickly as you can. And you know, in this time of year, it's time to start looking at you know, interior and exterior care. We could go on and on about what all you could do in terms of protectants and waxes and things like that, but the simplest thing you can do is to regularly wash that car through the winter months and get the salt off of it to prevent that kind of damage from starting to occur, because it's a lot easier to prevent than it is to correct once it's occurred.
Yeah,
so
what happens,
I'm going to be all about prevention.
What happens when you do see signs of rust? Is there anything you can do?
Well, get it addressed as quickly as possible, because they say rust never sleeps, and that's true. You know, it once it starts, it's going to be progressive, like some kind of a disease. And you know, so the earlier you get on top of it, the earlier you get it corrected, the less you're going to have to worry about it. So if you see a little spot, you know, don't leave it go. Get something done. Get it corrected, coated, and repaired, so that it doesn't, you know, continue to spread and cause problems from one part of the car to another, to another, to another.
Got a follow-up here for Lily, who kept having her headlights go out, burning out. Joan from Hayward emailed us. She said, in addition to incorrect handling of headlight bulbs, she says Subaru did have a problem with headlights. Joan's 2010 Outback kept blowing out lights, about 14, she says. After complaining to the corporate offices, Joan received a headlight warranty card, which noted coverage of Outbacks and Foresters. So there may be a follow-up there for you, Lily, if you're interested in following through. And earlier, Jim, you'd also mentioned the importance of keeping a car kit. And as we've gone through the questions over the last 90 minutes of these cars, I can't help notice how old these cars are that people are working hard to try to keep on the road, including my own. So what kind of car kit do you need out there? What should be in it to keep your car going for as long as possible?
Well, you know, the kind of emergency kit isn't necessarily what's going to keep your car going. It's what you're going to need, you know, when the unlikely happens, you know, some kind of a breakdown. So, you know, the first things that you want to think about in that kit are things to keep you safe, you know, some kind of a, you know, lighter flare, that so you can be seen in a situation, you know, something, you know, extra clothes and warm clothes and blankets for winter time, some food. You know, it's not always practical to keep water in a car because it can freeze in the wintertime, but, you can keep water in containers that can freeze and can get thawed out. But then for the car itself...
penetrating oil, I've got that on the list.
Penetrating oil, you know, your tire pressure gauge, you know, and this is the kind of thing I could go off the top of my head. You can look up lists of good things to keep, but to keep in the car. But you know, really, that it's a matter of preparedness. You know, think ahead and think about what you may need in any given situation. And these are not real complicated things. You don't need a full toolkit. You're not likely to fix your car yourself. So it's more, what are you going to do to keep yourself safe and to keep your car able to be seen if you do have a breakdown? You know, I think about that situation of somebody thinking they're going to be sitting along the interstate for 20 minutes, changing a tire, and it turns into 4 hours. You know, that you're probably going to wish you had some flares or some kind of system to alert drivers further down the road that you're sitting there. You know, those are some things that wouldn't seem like they're very important, become very important when a situation like that, you know, comes up and you're in a very dicey situation along an interstate. So, off the top of my head, I'm just not going to be able to give you a list of everything I would put into that kit, but that is something that you can pretty easily look up and put a kit together of those kind of things. It is kind of amazing how you know, vehicles do and can last a long time. And really, preventative maintenance and just a little planning ahead can make just a world of difference. And whether, you know, that vehicle is going to get you 200,000, 300,000 miles, and whether it's going to be prone to cause problems that are going to put you in a dangerous situation, whether it's a breakdown or just some performance issue that you know, can put you up in a compromised situation. So, you know, plan ahead, preventative maintenance, look at that car, have it looked at or look at it yourself twice a year, and keep ahead of it.
Jim, thanks so much for joining us today and answering all those questions.
Absolutely. It's been great.
Yeah. Jim Ward, retired service manager at Smart Motors in Madison and a mechanic we can all trust. I want to thank everybody for the calls. I want to apologize for not getting to all the emails. But we're going to turn our attention next to bike maintenance as we get ready to ride through the summer. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and this is WPR News. Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today on WPR News. And we turn our attention now to bike maintenance and getting your bike ready for the season, perhaps pulling it out of the mothballs like I am. For those who bike all year round, I am impressed and wonder how you keep from sliding sometimes, but it is amazing to see. And you probably have some questions about bike maintenance as well. And if you haven't thought of that before, then how well is your bike performing for you? You can join our conversation conversation with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk at WPR.org. Our bike expert is Andy Kwan. He's back again, and he is the owner of Gibbs Bike Shop in Lake Mills. You can also subscribe to his Bike Farmer channel on YouTube. And Andy, welcome back to the Larry Mueller Show.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Now, the first thing I think of when pulling my bike out for the season after being tucked away all winter are the tires. And so let's just start there. What am I looking at for my tires this spring as I get it ready to roll?
Well, I get this a lot at the shop. People think that there's something wrong and they have flat tires and they need to be fixed. And the first thing I always check is, do they have the same amount of air in each tire? If one is flat and the other one's just kind of squishy, mm-hmm. that means one's got a hole in it and the other one doesn't. If they're both just kind of squishy, you can just generally put air in the tires, make them firm, and go for a bike ride, and you'll be just fine.
Squishy is good news for this guy, but what else is happening to my bike as it winters all season in the basement?
Yeah, so generally speaking, if your basement's dry, that's a good thing. Bicycles do not like to sit for a very long time. A lot of times I say the number one thing you can do to make sure your bike is working properly is ride it every once in a while. There's a lot of lubrication that came from the factory. It's in the shifters, and they kind of gums up if you don't use them. So that's the first thing, is I squeeze the brake levers and kind of work the shifters just to kind of feel to see how gooey that old lubrication has gotten over time.
And how gooey what amount of gooiness are you looking for?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's kind of hard to, it's pretty subjective, and I just, I have the experience, right?
But you don't want it crusty, I imagine. I mean,
yeah, you don't want it crusty. You know, you don't want things to feel, I don't know, just kind of half stuck. You know, you want everything to be slick and snappy and clicky.
Yeah, how often would you think about taking your bicycle in for a tune-up? Is it an annual thing?
I do think it's an annual thing. I suggest that, you know, you just pick a time of year to do it. Generally speaking, the shops are pretty busy this time of year,
right,
and in the heart of the season. So you can generally tune your bike up in the fall and hang it up for the season and put air in the tires in the spring and you'll be just fine. But a lot of people do wait till the spring so everything's snappy from the get-go.
And ready to ride. How did you get into the bike shop industry in the first place?
You know, I think it was just, I got bit by the bug when I was a kid, like a lot of us do. You know, I think between your teddy bear and your driver's license, you know, you have your first bicycle. those of us that are lucky enough to have that, it really bit me. And so when I was 13 and thinking about a job, the one place in town, I live out in Lake Mills, it's a small town, and we had a little bike shop downtown. And I said, that's where I want to work. Well, I know it now because I own the shop, that, you know, there's really not enough money in it to have employees, especially 13-year-old ones. But those guys let me hang out at the shop and learn a few things kind of cut my teeth there a little bit. And then when I went to college in Madison, I worked at Budget Bicycle Center on Regent Street for many years.
So Gibbs Bike Shop, that was around back when you were a kid. That's where you got started, and that's the business that you now own.
Yeah, for the most part. So Gibbs Bike Shop was actually opened up in this location in 1933 by Gilbert Kirsten. And then he kept it as like a part-time thing for his whole life while he lived here till about 1990. And then there was another interim shop called the Bicycle Clinic, and that's kind of where I started. But I got my first bike right here at Gibbs, and I live here now. I named my son Gibson 10 years before I reopened the shop.
Andy, that is a great story, and I just love hearing about it. And we do have some questions here about bike maintenance and getting it ready for the summer. I want to remind you can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Nina in Menasha. Nina, good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I own a vintage Worksman cycle. I don't know if you're familiar with that brand.
Yeah.
They're one of the last companies in the United States to hand make bikes.
Yeah.
Out of New York. Okay. And I have an industrial hauling tricycle. And cool. to find someone, I know I love it, and I've done it all myself except for I'm bought Kevlar wheels, but now I need to have the spokes trued, and they're extra thick, so nobody can really true my wheel. Do you have any suggestions?
Oh, man. As soon as you said Worksman, I knew what was coming. yeah, I mean, I don't know if I do motorcycle shops, maybe.
Oh, you because know, they'd I mean, be thicker.
Can, yeah, I don't know how much wheel truing they do. But yeah, I mean, maybe they have bigger spoke wrenches, that kind of thing. You know, I guess it depends on like how out of true are they really? Do you really need to make them that straight because there's not brakes? A lot of times those bikes have fenders on them. Maybe they're rubbing on the fenders, but.
Andy, what do you mean when you say truing your bike tire?
Yeah. So truing a wheel is making sure that the rim is straight and, you know, you put it up in a stand and you can kind of spin it. And so you don't get any wobbling side to side or up and down. You know, you want to make sure it's round. And rolling true is like straight, and so we have a way of doing that, and you do that by loosening and tightening certain spokes depending on which side of the hub they go to.
Best of luck, Nina, and that that industrial tricycle sounds awesome, and the vintage Worksman, good luck. I'd be interested in hearing a follow-up to that. I had an issue with my bike last year. It was making a click when I was pedaling, Andy. And I have bike mechanic friends in the neighborhood. And the first question they asked me was, when's the last time you greased your chain? And I said, why do I need to grease my chain? Pulled out a rag, some good chain grease, and that click went away right away. So I'll ask you, how often should I be greasing that chain?
Well, I don't think you ever really want to put grease on a chain. Do want to get some chain lube and
there you go.
Lubricate your chain once in a while. I know it's a matter of semantics, but...
No, that may make a difference.
Yeah, it really depends on how much you ride and where the bike is stored and that sort of thing. I would say, you know, I put a couple drops on each link. You know, I just kind of really lightly lubricate my chain once a month or something like that.
So this is something you should have on hand.
Yeah, I think so. If you ride regularly, but you know, then again, you know, for the casual rider, you know, unless it's rusting, just go for a bike ride. Enjoy yourself. Who cares if it's making a little clicky noise?
What are some of the other things that I should have on hand for my bike that are quick, cheap, easy fixes that can maintain it for the long run?
Well, I kind of half jokingly say that the number one most profitable question I have is, do you have a decent pump?
Yeah.
Because most people don't. They have some sort of inflation device, but not a decent bike shop quality pump. But bike tires lose air a lot faster than car tires. And, you know, you always want to make sure that you at least have a firm tire. Once you get a little more experience and know exactly what tire pressures you like, then you can dial it in. But I think a good pump and keeping your air pressure dialed in is good. A little bit of lube is always a good idea to have on hand. But like I said before, I think the number one thing you can do is just ride your bike regularly. And a lot of times, when you think something's off on your bike, it's not a big deal. You can just swing by the bike shop and they might be able to just tweak it out. Now, of course, they might find a million other things that they could do and suggest you get a tune-up, but it's probably time for a tune-up anyway.
Andy Quant, our guest, owner of Gibbs Bike Shop in Lake Mills, answering your bicycle questions at 1-800-642-1234. Or maybe you could help answer a few of our previous questions that you've heard, like Ben in Madison, who has a follow-up for Nina here. Ben, good afternoon.
Hi. So I just heard about the thick spokes problem and the truing.
Yes.
To be honest, I'm not familiar with the type of bike that Nina was talking about, but I do have an Aventon bike, which has really, really thick spokes. And I just had this problem. The rear wheel was pretty significantly out of true. It took a hit. And a regular bike shop told me that they could not work on it. They did not have the tools. When I took it to an Aventon dealer, who work on other bikes, of course, they had the necessary equipment and tools to work with those thicker spokes. And so I'm wondering if that might be an option for Nina when she was talking about her bike.
Perfect, Ben. Very much appreciate the possible solution for Nina and truing her wheels on her industrial trike. And maybe the Venton Bikes retailer would be a place to go. What do you think, Andy?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly worth checking. The Venton is an e-bike, and e-bikes have opened up a whole Pandora's box worth of problems for us, you know, bicycle service people, including that. Like, it's really kind of the wild, wild west out there with e-bikes, so you get a lot of different spoke sizes and that sort of thing, and it can be hard to navigate that. So a lot of shops are just kind of saying, nope, that's not the kind of product that we work on. And it's a problem. As far as going back to that tricycle, the tricycle wheels are very different than bicycle wheels. So they don't even really fit in a typical truing stand. And it's just kind of a very atypical situation.
I have a follow-up email here from Ian Madison. For those who are interested in biking year-round and braving the winters of Wisconsin, he says studded tires are the best. They've never slipped on ice once with their studded tires, and highly recommend for any folks who want to ride through the cold winter. Andy, are you a year-round bicycle rider?
I have been a year-round bicycle rider, and if I lived in a city and had a commute and road on sometimes icy surfaces, I would definitely be using studded tires. He's absolutely right. They are a game changer for winter commuters and make it possible.
You also have your YouTube channel, The Bike Farmer. Tell us a little bit about how that got started and what you found doing it.
So the YouTube thing is certainly an interesting new world I found myself in. I'm a napper. I like to take naps in the afternoon, and I was watching Bob Ross, Joy of Painting, every afternoon, and taking a quick 20-minute power nap. And one day it just dawned on me that the way he paints his paintings and does each episode is exactly the same method I use. Well, not exactly, but similar method to how I tune up bicycles. It's pretty much the same story with every bike. I do the same things with every once in a while something may pop up. And I was like, I wonder if I could make episodes like this of fixing bicycles like he does paintings and put them on YouTube. And then one thing led to another, and I started doing it. And now here I am, and that's what I do.
The Bob Ross of bike mechanics on YouTube.
Yep.
That's just perfect. Andy Kwan, our guest, he's the owner of Gibbs Bike Shop in Lake Mills. And as you heard, he also posts weekly on his Bike Farmer channel on YouTube, and he's answering your questions about bike maintenance and other bicycle questions you may have at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send us an email, talk@WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller, and this is WPR News. Join the Larry Mueller Show again tomorrow from 11 to 1 for Garden Talk. We'll find out how to grow the tastiest berries, and we'll get some advice on starting our seed growth indoors before we move them out for the season with our guest, Diana Alfuth. That's tomorrow on Garden Talk from 11 to 1 right here on WPR News. Right now, our guest is Andy Quant, owner of Gibbs Bike Shop in Lake Mills, answering your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send us an email, talk@WPR.org. And Andy, you mentioned electric bikes, and I want to get your take on them and when you think they are a good option or perhaps even a better option than the old analog bikes.
So I have an interesting-ish relationship with e-bikes. I think they're a really great option for people that want to ride bicycles for fun and don't want to have to work very hard, because they kind of literally ride themselves. You just have to get on them. And I think that's wonderful. As a service provider, there's a lot of problems with them. There's not a lot of standardization with the parts between the brands. A lot of the brands are just these kind of fly-by-night Chinese brands that pop up and then they disappear. It's kind of buyer beware, but I'm definitely not anti e-bike. I think they're a great form of transportation and recreation and solve that problem of bikes can be too hard to ride for many people. I kind of love them that way.
But one of the things I love about bikes is in many ways you're able to fix them yourself, and there's maintenance and mechanics of electric bikes make that even feasible.
Yeah, I mean, there are plenty of people out there that can fix them themselves, and it's just most people can't. Most people aren't do-it-yourselfers, and, you know, I've always said that bike shops or cycling stores are really service businesses with a retail arm. And it seems like a lot of e-bikes are being sold on the retail level, either through the internet or other ways, that there's no real service support. And it's becoming a big problem. So in my world, at least.
Yeah. What happens to somebody with an e-bike that can't find a service for it?
Yeah. I mean, there are people around that are doing it. And if they've figured out how to make money doing it, really happy they have, because I haven't figured it out yet.
How do you go about diagnosing a problem with a bike? Like mine last year with a little click to it, if it's got a weird sound or riding funny, where do you begin to figure out what the problem is?
Man, well, for me, it's pretty easy. I know bikes pretty well. I've touched a lot of them. I've fixed a lot of them. I've seen almost everything there is to be seen. Sometimes I do get stumped, but I can usually figure it out throwing it up in the stand. I know what to look for. If I can't figure it out in the stand, I can take it for a ride. Sometimes I do get stumped, you know, but and I try to explain it to people, like, you know, go for a ride and try a few different things and wait, listen to feedback from the machine and see if you can kind of narrow down where the problem's actually coming from.
I want you to settle a long-standing dispute for us about the proper seat height for a bicycle, Andy. Where should that fit?
Well, how I've always been taught, and I'm kind of a guidelines over rules type of guy, is when you're sitting on the saddle and at the bottom of your pedal stroke, you just want a slight bend to your knee. And that's wildly uncomfortable for many people because you're very, very, on most bikes, you'd be very, very tippy-toe if you're still on the saddle. And so that can be a problem for some people with balance and that sort of deal. But that's the proper way if you don't want to, like, get tight ligaments or hamstrings.
Yeah. So it would feel like maybe you're a little too tall.
You know, following that guideline, a lot of people, I just sold a bike this morning to a 13-year-old, and he was on a bike that was too small for him, like most 13-year-olds are. And when I put him on a bike that actually fit him with the seat on, you know, it was really uncomfortable for him to not be flat-footed on that seat.
Yeah.
And I kind of had to explain, you know, you can get off the bike by standing in front of the saddle, and, you know, there's certain things you can do to, but that's the proper way to do it.
Andy Quant, our guest and owner of Gibbs Bike Shop in Lake Mills. And would you walk us through fixing a flat tire? I feel pretty confident with the front tire, but when I get to the back tire and the gears, I get a little concerned. I don't know what I'm doing back there.
Yeah. So, you know, the back tire is a little bit more complicated because you have to navigate the gears and the chain and the derailleur and all of that. If you put the bike in the highest gear in the back, which is the smallest cog, it certainly helps get that axle in and out of the frame. But first thing you need to do is kind of disconnect your brakes so you can get that tire through the brakes. And then, you know, loosen up your rear wheel and pop it out. You know, there's the wheel, and then there's a tube inside the tire. And when we have a flat tire, we actually have a flat tube. The tire is just a casing around that tube. And you can patch the tube. It's kind of an old school way of doing it. Some people still do, or you can just replace it, which is what most shops do because it's a lot faster, more cost effective because the labor of patching is a little bit more than the cost of a tube.
But that I was wondering whether or not it's worthwhile carrying a spare tube with you when you go biking.
You know, it's only worthwhile if you know how to fix a flat on the road. side, you know, which not a lot of people do.
It would require having a pump on hand and some tools as well, I would suppose.
Right. Yeah, you know, you need to have a tire lever and a tube and the knowledge and some air, you know, to get yourself home or to get yourself somewhere where you can get a ride or something like that. Like I tell people, I don't really care about getting flat tires because it's no big deal for me to do that on the side of the road. But if it is a big deal, you should go home and practice. Find that YouTube video that shows you how to do it that you relate to, and then just do it 10 times. You'll figure it out. And, you know, it's It's not rocket surgery. I figured it out.
Andy, what's the difference between good brakes and bad brakes on a bike?
Oh, well, how much time do you got? You know, I like my brakes to be snappy and firm, you know, much like in a car, but not too grippy. And so, you know, a lot of times there's mechanical limitations on what we can do as far as brake adjustments go. But, you know, a lot of bikes these days are being built with disc brakes. There's the general consensus that they're superior in every way. There's a lot of old school mechanical kind of guys like me that disagree with that, that think that rim brakes are just fine for most used cases.
Thank you.
You know, the disc brakes are great. They perform very well, and when they're set up, they are better. But they're a little more finicky and can be harder to set up and a little bit, you know, I don't know. There's a trade-off a lot of the time with brakes.
Sure. What would you tell somebody who would want to pursue a career in bike servicing and have a bike shop of their own someday, like you went from 13 to today with?
Oh, man. What's the old Willie Nelson song? Don't let your babies grow up to be cowboys.
Oh, wow. Is that your advice is a Willie Nelson song? Nice.
I mean, I tell parents all the time when they, you know, they bring their kids in and they get a bike. And I'm like, if they end up working at a bike shop when they're 40, don't blame me. You know,
a lot of people that have worked at bike shops, Andy, including you.
It's the best job. Yeah. It's the best job on the planet.
People love it, and
it's great. It just doesn't pay very well. You hardly ever get benefits. I mean, it's a whole thing. Like, there's a lot of grumpy bike shop employees because, like, it's just the best place to work. It always is. The people are very interesting. It's a wonderful activity. It's kind of a cool sport. You know, you get a lot of characters. That's all the reasons I love it so much.
And you get to fix things, right? I mean, the nice part is you're fixing things for people every day.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's all I ever wanted to do. You know, I've had a few real jobs in my life, and the whole time I just wanted to be fixing bikes. So
I think most people would consider business owner as a real job.
You know, I mean, I don't know, self-employment. I always think like most self-employment people, it's like, you know, you don't want to have a real job, so you become self-employed. I'm super grateful, and it's never lost on me how lucky I am to have figured this out and cracked the code to be able to do this. You know, it's a labor of love, and you know, I'm doing well with it. So I think that's great.
Yeah, it is amazing. And I I'm going to be pulling my bike out of the basement here probably over this weekend, maybe tomorrow with the nice weather in Madison. But if I pull it out and it is all, if it's not what it used to be, at what point do I start thinking about a new bike, Andy?
That's a great question. So, you know, if you really are riding it and you really don't like it, then it's probably time for a new bike. If you think it's just mechanical problems, I would say take it to your local bike shop, have them put it up in the stand and let you know everything that they see and write up service for it. Sometimes if the service gets to the point of what it would cost to replace it, you have a choice to make. Some people are like, oh, I don't want to get rid of my old bike. I love it. I've had it all these years. People like me are like, yay, new bike day. You know, that's all the excuse I needed to get myself this one of these new modern bikes.
What if I'm finding a little bit of rust on the frame? Is that a concern and cause for going shopping?
Surface rust doesn't bother me a whole lot.
Okay.
You know, if things are really rusty and things are in really bad shape, then yeah, new bike time. And, you know, just think about, you know, are you just using this to ride around the block and, you know, a very, you know, casual, leisurely rider? Or is this something that you want to be part of your life? If it's going to be something you want to do on a regular basis, go treat yourself, get yourself a nice bike, get yourself the right one.
Andy,
and I think any bike shop can help you figure that out.
Andy, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Andy Quant's the owner of Gibbs Bike Shop in Lake Mills, and you can subscribe to his Bike Farmer channel on YouTube. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and thank you for joining us. It's a work of a lot of a full team. Our producers are Clara Neipert and Joel Patenaude. Our technical director is Jeff Robbins. Our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. And stay tuned for more here on WPR News, and join us again tomorrow for Garden Talk from 11 to 1.